Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk with Alistair Whitett, European Equity Portfolio Manager at Comgest. U.S. stocks have dominated non-U.S. stocks for a decade, but at some point that script will likely be flipped and investors may benefit from more exposure to places like Europe. We talked to Alistair about his focused and high conviction investment strategy, which combines growth and quality type investing. We also talked to him about some of Europe's most well-known brand names and the moats they have around their businesses and profitability, and how Alistair identifies these types of businesses and sticks with them for the long term, and much more. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Comgest's Alistair Whitett. This episode is brought to you by Alpha Architect for Advisors. Whether you're an established firm or just starting out, you know the right systems can be the difference maker to achieving your growth goals. That's why Alpha Architect now offers a suite of turnkey model portfolios that can be customized to fit your practice. Built on Alpha Architect's decades of rigorous academic research, our model portfolios aim to systematize portfolio management so that you can spend less time tinkering with funds and more time finding your next great client. Systemize today to save time tomorrow. That's building with conviction. That's Alpha Architect for Advisors. To learn more about Alpha Architect's model portfolios and to schedule a consultation, visit advisors.alphaarchitect.com/models. That's advisors, A-D-V-I-S-O-R-S, .alphaarchitect.com/models. Alpha Architect for Advisors, built with conviction. Hi, Alistair. How are you? Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about European investing today, the opportunities that you're seeing across Europe. I think some of the big secular trends that you and your firm see when you look out over the next decade, your investment process, concentrated investing, and a whole bunch of other things. You know, I think one of the things, because Jack and I are here in the US and many of our listeners are in the US, one of the, I guess, things that, you know, we find interesting is that as investors here, and in a lot of countries, you have a home bias. So, you know, a lot of investors invest more where they're located. And I think particularly given the performance of U.S. stocks, the relative outperformance over U.S. stocks over many different markets over the past 10 or 15 years, you know, many investors are underweight different types of international markets. But U.S. stocks also look relatively expensive compared to many other parts of the world. So I think, you know, this discussion today is going to be a good one and an important one when we think about, you know, where we potentially want to be looking for the next decade and where some of those, you know, good values might be. So this will be fun. This will be good. Jack and I don't know a lot about investing in Europe, so we're looking forward to the conversation.
Great.
You have, I want to start a little bit before we get into all that with your background. It's always interesting when Jack and I have these guests on, and you know, you went to school and I believe you studied geography in college. And, you know, that's a big switch from studying that field coming into investing. Oftentimes, really good investors have very different diverse backgrounds. They're not all finance or economic majors. So I don't know. We just want to kind of get a little bit more on sort of, you know, how you transitioned from that field to investing. And maybe if there's anything that you, in that educational process that you learned that has helped you become maybe a better investor.
Sure. So my path, as you say, into this world was somewhat unusual. So I've always had an interest in investing. When I was young, my father actually asked each of us children to pick a stock. I was about 12 or 13 at the time. And it was in the late 90s, and every day we would go and open up the FT, find the share price, and plot it on a sheet of paper. And you know, like true herd mentality, we all picked tech stocks at the time. And so the share prices kept falling, and we actually had to get another piece of paper and stick it underneath the first one to keep tracking the share prices. So it was an early, I guess, an early lesson in bubbles. But so there's always been an interest. And when I was at university, I then did some work experience with First State, which is a quality growth manager in emerging markets. And I found it extremely interesting. And so that then kind of, you know, fed my desire to then move into the industry. And you're right that it is unusual to go from geography into finance, but I actually don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. And I think the finance industry tends to over-index in very quantitative-minded people who can build some excellent models and can build some very precise DCFs. And the reality is the numbers are the output. You know, if a business has a high gross margin, if the business is very cash generative, it's probably because there is a qualitative factor that led to it. So they either have a very unique business model or they have a very strong culture, you know, very high barriers to entry, whatever it might be. And so actually, I think that the fact the industry over-indexes in quantitative people slightly misses the why. And so I think there is some value to having a social sciences background or a background other than financial quantitative modeling, or you know, that kind of mindset.
Yeah, I think that the asking the why is important. You know, Jack and I, we run quantitative models here, so you know, we build the models, they do what they do. You know, half the time we don't know what stocks are in our models, we just know that they passed our model screen. But you know, there is always a why, and a lot of times that shows up in the fundamentals, but understanding that I think is important.
Absolutely. No, and I think it is a, you know, I would encourage those who don't have financial backgrounds to not be scared. I mean, you need to be numerate. I think you need to do basic maths, but I think, you know, from a long-term fundamental standpoint, it's not the numbers that gives you the competitive advantage. It's seeing the other stuff that matters. And so I'd encourage those with social sciences backgrounds certainly to consider the industry.
Just one more thing on that. Peter Lynch once said, if you can't explain the reason why you bought the stock to your mother in like 30 seconds or less, you probably shouldn't be buying it.
I agree. Yeah.
One of the things, so, you know, here in the US, and I think this has happened sort of around the world, you know, we had very high inflation coming off of 2020, early 21. Here in the US, inflation has been moderating, although you know, there's some debate around whether or not it's going to come down to the 2% level that the Fed's targeting. But can you just give us an overview of what's going on in Europe with inflation right now?
Sure. So it's very similar to the US. I would say it's maybe slightly more extreme because the war in Ukraine led to a spike in raw material prices. The gas price hit a stratospheric high, and that led to higher inflation. So we actually, you know, we were in double digit territory in Europe. So that has been coming off since the start of the year. And I think the easing of those inflation pressures are partly why the market is up. I think also there was fears around a recession last year that has not materialized, at least yet. So I think those factors have helped. I would say, however, like in the US, you know, the number to look at is core inflation. You know, the headline inflation we knew would come down with the normalization of those energy and some food prices, but the real question is what happens to core inflation. And it's I can't remember which central banker it was who said it's like a toothpaste bottle inflation. It's much easier to get the toothpaste out than it is to put it back in again. And so once you've started this cycle of inflation, it's very difficult to tame it. So I think what we're looking at and what I think one should look at is the core inflation and see that easing before we get overly excited about the easing.
As a portfolio manager, how much do you care about macro variables like that? I mean, we'll talk to some people who say we're bottom of stock pickers, we just don't care. We'll talk to other people who say, well, it does have to influence like the sectors we're going into and things like that. So where do you fall on that spectrum?
So we fall very much in the category of we don't want to have to worry about this. So we don't think we have a real competitive advantage in predicting macro factors. So let's try and remove it. And at the end of the day, all we need is a portfolio of 30 odd stocks. And if we can find 30 where macro is less relevant, then all the better. So what does that mean? That means that we don't invest in cyclical industries. We avoid the capital goods type industries. For other reasons, we avoid, you know, raw material and gas type sectors, you know, the banking sector. And we focus on businesses. We avoid regulated businesses as well, because we don't want that external factor to be a problem. So we just try and find businesses where as much as possible, they're in control of their own destiny. And that frees us up a little bit from having to worry about these macro factors. And where there is a macro factor, so inflation, for example, is clearly going to impact all businesses. We want the businesses to have defense mechanisms that mean that they don't have to worry too much about it. So pricing power, high gross margins. It was very interesting last year. We did a compare and contrast of our different companies and the extent to which inflation was important. And you compare L'Oreal and Unilever, both of those in very similar industries. And you just look at the conference call transcripts of the first half. How often was inflation mentioned? How often was supply chains mentioned? In the case of L'Oreal, it was a handful of times. In the case of Unilever, I think it was something like 40 or 50 times. In the case of Hermès, it was zero. That tells you everything about the extent to which these factors matter for these companies.
That's actually interesting. Do you do a lot with that? Like, I always am interested when I talk to managers, this whole natural language processing thing that's going on, you know, really going through these transcripts and looking for words and stuff like that. Do you, as a manager, do you use that a lot in your process?
We don't use tools to do that. But obviously we're doing that ourselves by reading and listening to the transcripts, or to the calls. But no, we don't use a tool to do that.
I was listening to an interview you did in preparation for this, and it was really good. I believe it was with Morningstar. And you were talking about three mega trends that you think are really going to influence, you know, Europe over the next 10 years. And I thought they were really interesting. So I was hoping I could work through them one at a time. And the first one here is energy transition. So could you talk about that and why you think that's important?
Yeah, so this is obviously a major, major priority for the world. Europe, I think, from a regulatory standpoint, is probably further ahead than most other markets or most other geographies. And they've decided, or they've got an ambition to reach net zero by 2050, to reduce CO2 emissions by more than half, I think it is, by 2030. And they're putting regulation in to help facilitate that. And they're regulating us, of course, as investors, and they're regulating companies. So this is a clear priority. And we're seeing it, by the way, in the companies that we invest in. I mean, it is going further and further up the agenda. I always think, you know, if you want to see how important something is, go and look at the most cost-conscious company, and that's Ryanair in Europe, so the low-cost provider of airlines. And for a very long time, they didn't talk much about their environmental credentials. It is now their top priority. In each of their press releases, in each of their results, it's the first thing they talk about. They're advertising about it a lot. They're actually one of the companies investing the most in sustainable aviation fuels. And why are they doing that? Why would Ryanair do that? They do it because it really matters. It's going to matter to their business. It's not just words. This is going to matter to their business. And it's going to matter for a number of reasons. It's going to matter because there are carbon credits that they're no longer going to get. So they're going to have to pay for their carbon, or the free credits, that is. Their customers care about it. So they're going to have potentially an impact on the desire to travel with them. So it's a real factor. And so we think this is going to be increasingly important. And there are companies that are potentially going to suffer. Heineken famously last year came out with an estimate of 2.4 billion euros. That's almost their entire EBIT. 2.4 billion euros if they don't transition. And there they just assumed at some point the government will charge us €100 per ton of carbon. If we apply that to all of our emissions, that's going to cost us 2.5 billion. So we need to transition. So it's going to be a cost for some companies, if they're slow in particular. It's going to be an opportunity for others. And there are companies that can provide solutions. Companies like Sika, it's a provider of ingredients for the construction industry. And their ingredients allow constructors to reduce by something like 40% the CO2 intensity of cement. So this is going to be a big opportunity for their customers. All of their customers have green transition roadmaps. They need to get there, and Sika is going to help them do that. So it's going to be a big theme for all companies. Some it's going to be a threat, some it's going to be an opportunity, but it's definitely something that we have to be on top of.
Yeah, I like that Ryanair example. I mean, when the most cost-conscious company is looking at a trend, you probably know it's something that's important and
it's
something
serious.
You need to pay attention to.
It's serious. Absolutely.
Your second one you listed was digitization. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I mean, this is obviously not a new theme. I mean, from my very first failed investment, it's a very important theme. I think it's accelerated though, and I think it's accelerated for a number of reasons. There's a confluence of factors that mean that it's getting to a critical mass that means it accelerates. COVID has helped. From one day to the next, almost the entire world population was working from home, and companies had to adapt. And a lot of them realized they just didn't have the infrastructure, and they hadn't sufficiently invested for that new world. And so they are investing more now. So we're seeing an acceleration, and I think that is going to continue. AI is only going to accelerate that. And again, those companies that are ahead of the curve will benefit. Those that are behind will suffer. And there are companies who can help with that digitization. So you take a company like Accenture, they've seen an acceleration of their growth. Companies will go to them to help them with their transition. Software companies will benefit. And of course, the seller of the picks and the shovels, ASML, which sells the machines that are used to make semiconductor chips, which will be used to run all of these digital processes. You know, they are clearly highlighting that they see a runway for growth that's far above what they've seen in the past. So I think this is going to be a big theme again, and there are some great businesses that are nicely exposed to it.
And the last one I thought was really interesting is an investment theme, and that's the aging population. Can you talk about how you think about that?
Yeah, so that again is not necessarily new. Between now and 2050, I think it is, the number of over 60s will double, the number of over 80s will triple. That will result in increased healthcare spending. Healthcare spending is not cyclical. That's what's great about it. So since records began in the US, there has not been one year where healthcare spending has fallen, not COVID either, and that's certainly not going to be a trigger for it to fall. So this is a beautiful tailwind for businesses, which is both long-term, structural, and non-cyclical. And so again, there are lots of opportunities to get exposure to that. And in fact, in Europe, the array of opportunities has widened with time. So if I go back to the 90s, we were talking largely pharma companies. Today we've got a whole load of companies that are suppliers to that pharma supply to those pharma companies. We've got companies that are in the medical device sector. We've got some great dental implant companies like Straumann, hearing aid companies like Amplifon. So I think there's an array of opportunities to invest in businesses which all have the same theme in common, which is that populations are aging, healthcare spending will continue to increase, and they can leverage that.
How do you think about these trends in totality when you build a portfolio? Like, on one hand, obviously you want to invest in companies that benefit from them. I guess on the other end of the spectrum, you also want to maybe avoid companies where these things are going to be problematic over time. But how do you think about them when you're starting at the top to try to build your investment portfolio?
So we never start with the trend. And I think that's a really important caveat, because if you invest, there's a lot of errors by investing in trends. I mean, if I had told you 40 years ago that air traffic would grow at 5% per year, you might have decided to buy Air France. And Air France's share price today is lower than it was 40 years ago. So you'd have lost a lot of money on that investment. So you have to start with a business and find a great business. Then what you tend to find is that the great businesses, often if they're a growth business, have a tailwind. It's easier to sail in, you know, with the wind than to try and tack up against it. And so then we think about, okay, well, what are these tailwinds that are benefiting the companies? And they are the likes of digitization, healthcare, aging populations. So I think it's you start with the business, and then ex post you realize there's a nice tailwind. And then what you've got to do is make sure that you're not running the same risk factors. So what we don't want to find ourselves is investing in a suite of companies that all have the same risk factor. It could be US healthcare, reform, or it could be, I don't know, some other form of regulation. So then we just got to make sure that we're diversifying the risk factors sufficiently.
Before we talk about your process a little bit more, I want to ask you more about the universe. In the US, the growth universe is pretty tech dominated, and it's becoming more so. I'm just wondering, what is sort of the sector composition, some things like that you could tell us about Europe and how it differs from the US?
Yeah, so Europe, I would say, has three really big strengths and historical strengths. The first is we have some of the best brands in the world, especially in the luxury space. I mean, we have brands that are 150, 200 years old, Hermès, Louis Vuitton, but you see it elsewhere, L'Oreal is over 100 years old. And Europe has a great know-how of how to manage brands. I mean, I'm in France at the moment, and the best and the brightest who leave the École de Commerce, the big French universities, they will tend to go to L'Oreal, to Louis Vuitton, to Hermès. That's where the brightest minds go. So we have culturally a know-how of brand building, and we have historically some of the oldest brands. So there we find a lot of good opportunities. The second area I would say is healthcare. You know, obviously Louis Pasteur was European, and since then we've had a number of great pharma businesses. Novo Nordisk today is one of the biggest companies in the world selling diabetes and anti-obesity products. But then around that has built a supply chain of companies that, for example, Lonza that manufactures drugs. You have Sartorius Stedin that sells single-use products used in that manufacturing process. So we have, in the pharma space, a lot of good opportunities. And then more generally in the healthcare space, we have a number of great med tech companies as well. So that would be the second area of great ideas. And then finally, in the digital space, we have some great software companies. We don't have the fangs of the US. We don't have the platforms, but we do have businesses like SAP, obviously, were the first ERP companies. And then some great software companies like Dassault System, like Amadeus in the travel industry. So I'd say those are the three areas: healthcare, brands, and software.
One thing I find interesting is that in Europe, some of the biggest and most well-known brands are actually companies that have been around, to your point, 100, maybe 150 years old. Where in the U.S., we don't really have that. Like maybe a General Electric or maybe an ExxonMobil, but really the big brand names are the Apples of the world, sort of like the FANG names to some extent, Berkshire Hathaway maybe. So although Berkshire's been around a while, so it's an interesting, and I wonder if it's to your point, if it's more of a cultural sort of thing that's embedded in the businesses there. It's just an interesting observation.
Yeah, I think so. I think also the examples that we've given are examples where the brand, the history is part of the brand. I mean, partly why you buy an Hermes handbag is because there's a heritage that is 150, 200 years old. They don't shy away from that. Their advertising shows, the history of this of that brand. So that's kind of what you're buying into. Whereas when you're buying, I guess, a PC or a phone, you don't really care if that's been around for 200 years or not. You're buying something else. So I think that the history of these brands is part of their competitive advantage. And it's part of why there are so few examples in the luxury space of new brands launching and being successful. Cultural heritage is part of what you're buying when you buy those brands.
So going back to your universe, it would be fair to say that the universe you look at relative to what a U.S. growth investor looks at, your universe is probably a lot less tech dominated than the U.S. guy would see. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's fair, yeah.
So getting into your process, you talked about two different things in your process. One is growth and the other is quality. And I want to dig into those individually. How do you think, when you're trying to find a great growth company, how do you think about defining growth?
Yeah, so for us, there are a few things that we like in growth. We like businesses that have longevity of growth. So how do you make money as a growth investor? It is not, at least for us, it's not about correctly or better predicting the next 5 years of growth. The market tends to do quite a good job of that. And that's why these companies trade on premiums. What matters is the longevity of the growth. The reason you make a huge amount of money investing in Coca-Cola in 1919 when it IPO'd or in L'Oreal is because these companies have not grown for 5 or even 10, they've grown for decades. And it's that compounding over decades that generates substantial returns. So longevity of growth is really, really important. And how do you generate long growth? Or what's the best way of generating it? It's organic growth. It's internally generated sales growth. So investing in a business where the margin goes from 10 to 20% can be a very profitable investment, but it's not the most durable way of growing. That margin will hit a ceiling at some stage. Likewise, a company that grows through acquisitions is you could be successful for a while, but there's a huge amount of risk associated with that. And it assumes that there is a never-ending list of companies you could acquire. So the best way to grow for a very long time, in our view, is through organic, internally generated sales growth. It's also, by the way, the growth that probably comes with the highest returns and is the most predictable. So that, I would say, is the most important factor when we think about growth.
And how about quality? When I talk to great managers, I think that's probably the thing that they define most differently. Like in our quant space, there's a lot of great quant firms in the US. And if you look at their definitions of quality, they're all over the place. And then you talk about people, obviously they associate quality with Buffett, but like trying to actually nail down what a quality company is really, really hard. So how do you think about that?
And you're right, it is very hard. And we've tried, to sort of simplify the way we think about quality, but it is a complex word to define. I mean, at its most simple, you know, quality for us is what enables these companies to sustainably grow. You cannot grow for 100 years if you don't have high barriers to entry. You know, at some stage that will have been competed away and then your growth will stop. So for us, quality is what will enable these companies. It's the input to enable these companies to grow for very long periods of time and in a predictable manner. And there are a lot of little traits that we look for. I mean, it's a list of, you know, hundreds of things that you might want. You know, longevity of management teams is a really common trait of high quality businesses. You know, L'Oreal has had 6 CEOs since its founding in 1910, and a lot of the best businesses have very long tenures of top management that enables them to implement consistent strategies. I mean, you know, consistently where we find our companies beating the lower quality businesses is because the lower quality businesses are constantly changing their strategies from one day to the next. These businesses have consistent ones. You know, a family backing is a really helpful quality input that enables the management teams to not worry about the next quarter or the next 2 quarters. They can invest for the long term because they know they have the backing of a family shareholder. There was actually a really interesting anecdote of the CEO of Assa Abloy who told us that he was presenting his ESG plans for the company to the board, and on the board is one of the family members. And the family member said to him, "That's all very well, but your plan, you'll be gone by the time this plan is delivered. I will still be here. My family will still be here. So how realistic is this plan?" That sort of mindset is the sort of thing that we find in great businesses. I mean, I've just given you a couple of examples, but there are so many others.
Yeah, no, and going back to what you talked about before about the great brands in Europe, I mean, quality is like one of those things you kind of know it when you see it. And, you know, when you think about those brands, like I would think about associating them with quality, even if I haven't looked at all the financial metrics and everything else, like those to me would define quality in some ways.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a very good example of the brands. I mean, my penny dropping moment when I realized how different Hermès and Louis Vuitton were to the rest of the luxury space was when I went to visit a department store, a luxury department store in Milan. And it was at a time when there was a price difference because of currency movements. There was a price difference between the bags in Italy and in China. And there's a concept called Daigu, where people will buy the bags in one market and go and sell it in another and win, you know, make money on the arbitrage. And so we asked the owner of this department store, you know, which brands are selling to these Daigu, which brands are not. And there were only 2 brands in this luxury department store that were absolutely not selling to these resellers, and that was Hermès and Louis Vuitton. And of course, short term selling to them makes sense. You've got free revenue there. But long term, you do dilute the brand. You don't manage the distribution. You don't know who those bags are being sold to. You don't know who's wearing those bags. So that was an interesting moment where, you know, we talk about quality being difficult to define. You know, there's no spreadsheet where that's or Bloomberg function to see that. You know, that's a very intangible factor, but it's extremely important to understanding why these are such strong brands.
And once you've found a company that's growing, that's high quality, how do you think about valuation? We talk to some growth managers who say, you know, with the great US tech companies, you really never could have worried about valuation. You had to just hold them for a really long period of time. And we talk to other ones who say, no, you have to at some point care about valuation. At some point, they get too expensive. So how do you think about that?
So I will start with a very broad statement, which is that on the whole, the market doesn't do a very good job of estimating the longevity of growth. And there's good reason for that, because it's very difficult to have that confidence. But if a company is able to grow for 30, 40, 50 years, I can almost guarantee you the market will not have been able to price that. And I can demonstrate that with an example. You know, we did the exercise. How much could you have paid for Coca-Cola when it IPO'd in 1919 and still made a better return than the S&P 500, which, by the way, is an absolutely exceptional index, as you know, which has delivered very high single digit returns over that period. And the answer is you could have paid 600 times earnings at IPO for Coca-Cola and still made a better return than the S&P over the next century. So the reality is, if the growth is durable, you can pay very high multiples and you will probably still make a lot of money. Now, the reality is you don't know that it will grow for 100 years. We don't have that sort of 2020 vision. So the way we think about valuation is less about, can we make money on the valuation? In other words, can we find a valuation arbitrage and make money? That's not the way we think about it. We think about it more as a risk mitigation. So if I'm wrong, I limit the cost of my mistake by being disciplined on valuation. I don't expect to make money due to the change in valuation long term, but I expect to limit the cost if I'm wrong. And so therefore, where we see big moves in valuation, so let's say more than one or two standard deviations above the normal, then we will start to act on valuation. If it's very small fluctuations, that's not something that overly concerns us.
It's interesting, you know, neither you or us is involved in the VC space, but they kind of have that same concept there. Like when they find the great companies at the beginning, they're not that worried about like tweaking the valuation exactly what they pay, because if you get that right, you know, it doesn't really matter what valuation you pay.
Exactly.
And that's been true also of the US tech companies. I mean, the great US tech companies, if you worried about their valuations at the IPO, you know, you could have paid twice the valuation that it came out at and you still would have done phenomenally well. So
indeed,
it's an interesting point.
Yeah. I don't think it's the best way to make money on valuation long term. The best way, in our view, to make money is by buying great businesses that can grow for a long time, and valuation will come second to that.
I'm not sure how much you think about this because you're not in the, you know, the quant space like we are, but in the quant space, we think a lot now about intangible assets, because when we looked at our standard valuation ratios, we got the Googles and all those things really wrong. Like there were a lot of intangible assets that were not showing up on the balance sheet that we missed. And I'm just wondering, do you think about that a lot in your process? Like the tech companies and the intangible assets are also, like in Europe, the big brands are obviously very, you know, big intangible assets. How much do you think about that in your process?
That's a very good question. And indeed, we actually ran the exercise. We've been running money in Europe for since 1989. So we picked a portfolio from the mid-90s, and we had a look at what was in that portfolio and compared it to today. And it is quite interesting. It reflected the world of the 90s. And of course, the portfolio today reflects the world of the 2020s. And it had a lot of businesses that are much more fixed cost, CapEx heavy. It was a lot of retailers, for example, who were rolling out big expansion plans around the world. And today, of course, they're much more intangible. They are much more capital light. I think in the end, the capital light model is probably a better one for us as investors, because it comes with higher returns. It tends to come with lower capital intensity and therefore better free cash flow generation. So I think that shift for us has actually probably been a good thing over time.
Just one more for you before I hand it back to Justin. I wanted to ask you, you run a high conviction strategy. You run a focus strategy, and we do as well. And, you know, one of the things we struggle with is when you run that type of strategy, you know, you probably get your best returns over time by being very focused. But by the same token, you know, you introduce tracking error. And, you know, as much as we like to pretend it doesn't exist in the real world, like a lot of people are looking at you against some sort of random benchmark, whatever that is they've picked. So how do you think about that balance between, you know, being focused, but also understanding that you have investors on the other side who might worry about benchmarks and tracking error?
Yeah, I mean, we're quite proud of our high tracking error, to be honest. I think what we want to do is find 30 of the best businesses listed in Europe and own them for as long as possible. I think it's dangerous to get hooked onto a index which is somewhat arbitrarily built. It's not a reflection of all the listed all the companies in that market. It just happens to be the ones that have decided to tap into, you know, listed equity capital at some stage and have stayed listed. The UK, for example, stock market is, I'm British, and the UK stock market is mainly made up of oil and gas companies, mining companies, and banks. And first of all, that doesn't reflect the UK economy. I mean, the UK economy, we don't have much mining activity in the UK. We don't have a huge amount of oil and gas activity. It's just that they're listed there. And second, I don't particularly want exposure to those businesses. They're not particularly exciting long-term growth businesses with high barriers to entry. So, from our perspective, we just want to find the best businesses, and whether or not that ends up with a high or low tracking error is almost secondary to us.
You had mentioned that you want to hold these companies for a long time. So in your mind, in the portfolio itself, like what would be your typical holding period? And then sort of the follow-up to that is, if you are selling something, you know, what goes into the sell criteria or sell decision for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you say, the idea is that we can, you know, our ideal is that we own the company forever. I mean, we've owned, L'Oreal in our strategy since 1989, since we started. And that would be perfect if we could do that across 30 companies. The reality is we can't, because there are not many companies that can do a L'Oreal. I think there was a statistic In the U, I think it was in the US, how many, you know, what percentage of companies can grow above GDP for more than 7 years? And it was something like a very low single digit percentage. So, you know, we know that statistically, when we buy a new company, we're probably wrong. This company probably won't be able to grow for 10, 20, 30 years. And so when we see that we're wrong, we cut it and we go and try and find the next one. And we keep turning the portfolio to try and find the next L'Oreal. So as a result, our average holding period ends up being something in the region of 5-6 years. But that's made up of companies that have been there for 34 years and others that have been there for 1 or 2 years. So then that coming to your second part of the question of, you know, how do we think about selling? Well, you know, it's related. Where we sell is where we think this company doesn't have what it takes to run the marathon. And typically, you know, we are much more sensitive to quality than we are to growth, because quality comes before growth. And getting quality wrong is a lot more painful as an investor than getting growth wrong. And I can give you an example of that in our experience. Two companies that we've owned in the retail space, Inditex and ASOS. And these are two retail companies, two growth companies. One, we got growth wrong. In the case of Inditex, it grew a lot less than we expected, but the quality was still there. Inditex, by the way, is the owner of brands like Zara, Massimo Dutti, et cetera. And then on the flip side, ASOS, an online retailer, we got the quality wrong. And when you get the quality wrong, the margins collapse, the earnings collapse, and the multiple collapses. So you get this sort of, you know, this double or triple whammy on your returns. Whereas in the case of Inditex, the multiple broadly held, the margins held, the returns held. It's just it didn't grow at 12%. Instead, it grew at 7. So we didn't make any money, but we didn't lose any money. So we're much more sensitive to quality than we are to growth. And where we see early signs of deteriorating quality, we're very quick to act.
Yeah, you know, there's investors have a tendency to when they're, you know, they cut their winning positions and they hold on to their losing positions. And there's that famous quote after Warren Buffett read Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. You know, he called Lynch and said, you know, this idea of, you know, don't cut your flowers to water your weeds. And it's this idea of trying to hold on Absolutely. To your winners, hold on to the flowers, the ones that are compounding for you. You know, don't hold on to the losers. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what, it's a very scary statistic that we don't always talk about because it can scare people. But if we look at the performance of the European strategy over the last 30 years, there are 10 stocks that have driven half of the performance, 10. And that's because those are the, you know, those are the flowers that you were talking about that we just held and we kept holding and we kept holding and they generate the vast majority of the returns. So yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious. I want to talk a little bit more about your process, but who for you, who are investors that you admire, whether they're in Europe, whether they're in the US?
Well, obviously Warren Buffett sits up there. You know, he's taught me a lot. You know, the common sense behind everything he says is so obvious that it's extremely interesting. The beyond that, I mean, in the European space, there are a number of quality growth managers that I think are interesting. You know, Terry Smith is a very interesting investor who I think has a very similar approach. Lindsay Train also another quality growth investor in Europe who I think is very interesting.
So, are there any quantitative aspects to how you go about selecting stocks, or is it really all starting with the quantitative and then doing the deep dives into the companies?
Yeah, so we start with a quantitative. It's helpful. So we will screen. There are 1,800 or so listed companies in Europe with a market cap of over €500 million. So that's as a useful starting point. And we will screen that quantitatively for high returns, typically 15% ROE. We'll screen it for earnings growth, last 5 years, expected 5 years. And that will spit out a list of, you know, a few hundred companies that we will then apply the qualitative screen to establish whether we think these are genuinely exciting long-term quality growth companies. But beyond that first screen, the quantitative part is actually quite limited.
When it comes to actually speaking to management, you know, there tends to be two schools of thought. Some investors say, you know what, we don't want to talk to management. We think they're biased. They're just going to tell us what we want to hear. Other investors think it's very important to talk to management to get a sense about what's going on in the business, you know, the overall industry, some of the trends, and that, you know, management is there to really inform them in a truthful way. Where do you fall in terms of talking to management about the underlying businesses?
I mean, we definitely, I would say, sit in the second camp. I have a lot of sympathy with those who sit in the first, especially, I think, if you don't meet management often, if you're a you know, a relatively short-term investor, I think meeting management can be quite misleading. I think, however, if you are a long-term investor, then it is extremely valuable. Apart from anything else, you know, these are the people who are running the business, defining the strategy. So understanding who they are, how they think, I think is very important. But then beyond that, I think as you build a relationship with management, you know, you can pick up on nuances, you can pick up on body language, you can pick up on, you know, wording, and that can give you some information as to, you know, how they see the world. So I think as a long-term investor, meeting management is extremely valuable. I think it teaches you a lot. I think if you are a short-term investor, I can understand why in the end, you know, you can end up being misled by what are always overly optimistic and ambitious management teams.
You had mentioned earlier that one of the characteristics, you know, for companies that have sort of large family shareholder stakes, you know, they tend to think very long-term. About the business and think like owners, not just, you know, somebody that's there to be the CEO for 3 years and get a big payday. But, you know, when you think about management that thinks long-term and strategically in terms of decades, you know, what other characteristics do you see in the underlying businesses that, you know, an investor could kind of look at and say, yeah, I do think they're, you know, thinking long-term. Like, I just think like in terms of like Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, like there's a lot of different things, but I think Buffett and Munger's like consistent messaging, to me at least, is like one thing that, you know, has over decades has been consistent. So you know that they're, I think, thinking in a long-term way because that's the message they've been talking about for, you know, decades. But I'm just wondering, is there anything else that jumps out at you?
Yeah, I think there's a few things to say. The first is that consistency is super important, and that is something actually that we like to do, is just take the last 20 years of presentations. How does this company present itself? Results presentations. You know, Ryanair has basically used exactly the same slide deck for the past, I mean, at least the past 10, 15 years, and I can't actually find the slides from before then. But, you know, they have the same metrics. They compare their cost base to all the other competitors. They show their market share in the different markets and overall. You know, so they show consistently the same metrics. And I think that is a really good indicator that this is a business that's being run in a long-term and consistent manner. Then of course there's, you know, when you talk to them, and again, this is where meeting management is interesting, but, you know, you get a sense for their time horizons. We asked, for example, the new CEO of Dassault Systèmes what his plans were for the company. It was quite an open question. And he started answering his, you know, desire to focus on the healthcare industry. He thinks there's a big opportunity, you know, in digitizing that part of the industry. And, you know, and after his spiel, we asked him, so what time horizon are you talking about when you talk about these projects? And he said, oh, well, that's my 2040 plan. That was his 20-year plan for the company. Now, that's quite interesting. I don't know many CEOs who will give you a plan and tell you, you know, and you realize it's a 20-year plan, not a 1 or 3 or 5 year plan. So I think, you know, I think, and Dassault Systèmes has always famously said they have 3 business plans. They have a 10-year plan, a 3-year plan, and a 1-year plan. And the 10-year plan is the most important one. So I think that is important. Now, I think there's another aspect which is really interesting, because the best businesses have a very long-term mindset. But one thing I've noticed is that the best businesses also have a shorter term focus of delivery. They're not just lost in a kind of world of long term and short term doesn't matter at all. They have a long term vision, but they want delivery today. And you talk to, you know, someone like Bernard Arnault, the founder of and owner of LVMH. You know, he clearly has a long term vision. He won't compromise the long term of his brands, but he wants delivery. And he wants to see results this quarter, he wants to see results next quarter, he wants to see consistent results along that path to the long term. So I think the best businesses actually have that combination of a family or something which allows them to have that long-term vision. But being listed is maybe not such a bad thing, because you're being held to account quarter after quarter by shareholders, and that forces the company to deliver on that long-term plan.
I thought the thing you said about metrics is really interesting to me because, like, especially in the US, like, unprofitable tech space, you see this a lot. You see, you know, it's not earnings or EBITDA, it's adjusted pro forma with a bunch of other words in front of it, you know, that keeps getting changed, you know, to make you look good. It's just interesting to see, like, the companies that are very consistent and report the same thing, you know, that's really important.
Absolutely. Don't get me started on those metrics. There's nothing that smells quality more than a business that gives you totally unadjusted accounts. That is one of the highest measures of quality in my books.
Well, I just want to say here before we wrap up with our standard closing questions, one of the things I really value about this conversation is, you know, even though we're talking about, you know, your European equity strategy, I feel like most of the stuff we talked about is evergreen that can be applied to any different type of investing market in the world, because these are, you know, sort of timeless, sensible sort of principles and things that you're talking about. So really, really appreciate, you know, you sharing this and jumping on with us today. It's been great. We like to ask all of our guests sort of a standard closing question, and that is, based on your experience in the market, if you could teach your average investor one lesson, what would that be?
I mean, it's very, I would say, biased by my experience and by, you know, by what I do for a living. But I would, you know, my biggest advice to anyone who's looking to, you know, invest in the stock market is to buy businesses, not to buy shares. I think people get very excited because they want to buy a share price that will be bought at 10 and sold at 12, and they get very kind of focused on that. If you're a long-term investor, and I think that can be fun, by the way, and I think you can make money doing that. But if you're looking to buy and hold for a long period of time, then you need to start thinking about buying a business, and then the share price comes second. So I would say focus on the best businesses, and you probably won't go far wrong by doing that.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Alistair. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. It's been very interesting.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.